Massachusetts Senate Judiciary Committee public hearing,
January 17th, 1977. Now get blowing.
Testing 1, 2, 1.
Oh, it should be.
Testing 1, 2, 1, 2.
Blow.
State Court Administrator, and I'm appearing on behalf of the Judicial Conference and also the Supreme Court in support of Senate Bill 223. This is strictly a clarification bill, and the purpose of it is to put in so many words in the statutes that a judge, a district or circuit court judge or appellate judge, who is involved in a lawsuit because of his official capacity as a judge, and who for one reason or another cannot be represented by the Attorney General, who ordinarily would represent a state official, including a judge, can employ private counsel to represent the judge in the case, and that the fees of that counsel will be paid out of the circuit and district judge's budget, which is superintended by the Supreme Court. We prepare that budget and handle it, and we authorize payment on it. At the present time, there is the Tort Claims Act in Oregon, which is ORS 30 and et cetera. It was completely rewritten in 1975 for the legislature that authorizes judges to be represented by the Attorney General or by insurance counsel if insurance coverage. And also ORS 185, 235 authorizes the Attorney General to represent state officials, and in case of a conflict of interest, to decline to represent them and authorize the official to hire private counsel, which I believe the statute says will be approved by the Attorney General, and the Attorney General can withdraw the authorization for such counsel. From a practical standpoint, we have a few cases every year, and they're increasing in number, where a judge is sued sometimes by the Attorney General or by a district attorney, and it's usually involving some ruling of the judge during a trial, and they bring mandamus to make him change his ruling or to rule in a certain way. And the Attorney General can't represent him because either the district attorney or the Attorney General is really the party who's brought the action against the judge. We've had other cases where a judge becomes involved in a legal dispute as to authority or jurisdiction with the county commissioners or some other county official, where again, the district attorney is probably representing the commissioners. The attorney general doesn't want to get into it because of his association with the district attorneys. He feels it should be a private attorney. And then the judges are uncomfortable in applying private counsel. They usually call the Supreme Court and get permission. In fact, we ask them to write us a letter and explain why they're in this lawsuit and why the Attorney General has declined to represent them. Then we authorize them to go ahead and employ private counsel, and then the bill is submitted to the Supreme Court. If it's a small bill and pretty straightforward, I approve it. If it's for several hundred dollars or seems to be expensive for the service rendered, it's given to the Supreme Court, and they make an actual ruling on it in conference. But we feel we're doing all of this without any real statutory authority, and most of us would think we'd be more comfortable with it if it was spelled out that this is a proper procedure. The Tort Claims statute and the statute about the Attorney General representing state officials or declining conflict of interest to us doesn't quite cover the situation of the judges, and particularly since it's a separate branch of government, and at least the policy has been that the court will approve the attorney who is employed and his fees rather than the Attorney General doing that. We have been operating all these years without such a statute, and it hasn't created an actual problem. It's just everybody's a little leery if they really are doing the right thing. The money for this purpose has been in the court's budget since, I think, 1971 was about the first year there actually was a line item budget. It was $4,000 or $5,000 for the biennium, and we've been spending anywhere from $3,000 to $4,000 or $5,000 lately. But say these cases against judges are becoming a lot more common than they used to be. A mandamus against a judge was maybe one or twice a year, and now it's two or three times a month. It's becoming a way of handling some situations, and many times the Attorney General cannot represent the judge. He does have to employ private counsel.
Questions of Judge Hicks.
Senator Brown. I apologize, Judge. I did not exactly follow why the Attorney General declined in some of these cases.
Well, he feels it's mainly basically a conflict of interest. He doesn't like to represent a judge against another government attorney. It's usually a district attorney. If the district attorney is representing the party suing the judge, the Attorney General's office declines to represent the judge. And occasionally, this is really rare, but it has happened occasionally, the judge will be the plaintiff. For instance, where the judge is arguing with the county commissioners about the salary of judicial employees or whether you should have a court reporter. There's been two or three lawsuits over who has the authority to set the salary or create the position. This results in a lawsuit between the two governmental agencies as to which is correct. And if there's a district attorney or an assistant attorney general on one side, the attorney general won't assign anybody on the other side.
In Section 2, however, it speaks exclusively to the situation where the judge requires a defense counsel. It's a defense situation.
Well, yes, after reading this draft, I think there's a couple of amendments we should make to it, and I would, if the committee is interested, I would submit some amendments after this hearing. But I would, that line 10, word defense, I think should be tendered, because it should be drawn, the word representation was used just for that unusual case where the judge might be a plaintiff.
Mm-hmm.
And the word defense really is in there inadvertently. It should be, I think, if the tender, if the Attorney General declines to accept the tender, the judge may employ private counsel. And also, there's no reference here to these other statutes, particularly the Tort Claims Act. And I sent this draft to the Attorney General's office, and they reviewed it. And the Attorney General recommended that some reference be made to the Tort Claims Act in this bill, or it could be interpreted later that this is exclusive, and that this is the only way for the judge to be represented, and it might take them out from under the Tort Claims Act and insurance coverage, which I kind of doubt if it would, but there is that risk, and we certainly don't want to do that. So perhaps a line should be entered here to refer to this other statute, that this is an addition to that and not meant to in any way replace it. What we're trying to accomplish here is not change anything, but to set out in the statute the policy that we have been following in granting the judges the authority to employ private counsel and how those fees of that counsel will be paid. Who determines whether they're to be paid and how much? There's nothing really that tells us that now.
Good question. Thank you very much, Judge.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else here to testify on this bill? Mick?
Hello, Mr. Gillard. Roger Brown, member of the committee. I'm Michael Gillette, State Solicitor General, appearing for what I'm sure the committee hopes is one of the few times I will be here this year.
But I doubt it.
but I fear not. Judge Hicks was kind enough to point out the existence of this measure late last week and to suggest that I might want to drop by. I am not appearing for or against the measure, but I did want to explain very quickly for the committee why this occurs in a little more detail. Right now, by statute, the Attorney General is responsible for defending state officers who are sued for acts committed, if that's the right phrase, in their official capacity. As a matter of practice, I normally am the lawyer assigned to that task. Usually, those cases involve, in the vast majority of cases, they involve a situation in which the judge is acting in a case in which the state itself is a party anyway, or one of its agencies is. And so the question of whether or not the Attorney General will accept the defense of the judge is very simple. If he ruled in favor of the state agency, then of course we will. If he ruled against it, we can't, because we already represented the agency which lost in that particular ruling. And normally these things arise under mandamus or writ of prohibition, writ of review, that kind of situation. There are, however, situations where a private attorney in a purely private action decides to bring mandamus against a judge because the attorney does not like some interlocutory order entered by the judge. And so he brings a mandamus action, normally in the Oregon Supreme Court. And there's a lawyer on the other side who has a paying client who is perfectly capable, usually, of dealing with the problem and who would be expected to have dealt with it before the trial court itself. And we've taken the position under those circumstances it would be improper for state funds to be expended to supply representation to a purely private interest. And so we've declined in those instances to represent the judge. And we've done that not only on the theory that it would be improper for the state to spend its money to represent a private litigant, but also on the theory that the judge really doesn't get paid by the head and he ought not to care what the ruling is one way or the other. That is to say, an instruction on what the law is something he then ought to follow in disposing of the case. Now that works in almost every situation, one rule or the other. Once in a while, however, a judge becomes involved in an argument with his own county and with the governing body of his own county with respect to, for instance, whether or not they will spend a certain amount of money for a court reporter or for certain additional facilities, which the judge feels that he needs. Classic example is Judge Wolf fighting with the county commissioners in Baker County, or the county court as it was in Baker County, concerning what they were going to pay his court reporters. In those circumstances, usually the judge himself is the plaintiff. And while he may ask the Attorney General for representation, the question of whether or not we should represent him is a policy question which has to be addressed on its individual facts. There's no way to suggest a general rule with respect to that. It was a purely private fight situation between the judge and his county officials, and that can happen. Then there's no reason to spend state money to pay for it. If it's anything other than that, if the judge is trying to effectuate a broad state policy, then we ought to get into it, because what is his interest is obviously the interest of the other judges in the 36 counties around the state.
So maybe less of that since he was defeated.
Well, I don't mean by that to suggest, one, that there was anything wrong with what Judge Wolf wanted in that case, or secondly, that he's the only one who gets involved in such battles. There was also a dandy fight in Multnomah County not too long ago about similar concerns. But in any event, we opt in or opt out depending upon, one, whether or not the state is a party, in which case we know where we stand in the argument to begin with, or two, if the state is not a party, if the defense of the judge represents the defense of some identifiable and outstanding state policy, or whether instead it is purely a matter of private concern between two private litigants. Now, if there are circumstances where the committee feels that the judge ought to receive state money to go ahead and obtain a defense anyway, then that ought to be done, I suppose. But short of that, I'm not entirely sure that this bill does anything that's appropriate for the state to do. What I'm really worried about is, whatever you choose to do with this measure, I would urge you to carefully confine what you authorize so that you don't end up funding the defense of a judge, one, in a case where you ought not to care what the outcome is, and secondly, where your tendering of the money simply permits a private litigant to get state paid for representation. And in that regard, let me point out one other thing. There are times when a judge feels his ruling is right and would like to see it sustained, because that's a normal tendency for any of us. But the judge also feels that if he had a really good lawyer on the other side in that case, the lawyer would get it sustained, but the fellow who happens to be representing the party on the other side isn't good enough. So he says, by George, I'd rather have the best lawyer in town instead, maybe Jim Clark, for instance. And he says, so he tells the Supreme Court, now in this case, I want Jim Clark. And I don't blame him for wanting Jim Clark. For up to me, that's who I'd want, too. But I'm not entirely sure that the fact the judge feels like he'd like to be sustained by the best lawyer in town is the proper policy judgment to make, or the proper policy judgment to authorize for the judge who happens to be the defendant in the mandamus proceeding.
Could you prepare some amendments for us that would narrow it down to what the need appears to be?
I've tried to figure out how. The thing that worries me is it seems to me any language that would be drawn would speak to a discretionary matter. And if you want to authorize it at all, I'm really more concerned about leaving it to Judge Hicks' discretion to make that determination. I can try. And if I can come up with anything, I'll submit it to the committee. But
yeah,
I'm not sure it can be done.
The best lawyer, Judge Hicks, wouldn't have his job.
Well, Judge Hicks might disagree with me as to who the best lawyer is, but he's at least not going to do it while Mr. Clark's here.
Send it to Forrest.
Nick, are there other cases besides when the Attorney General cannot because of the conflict of interest? What if this language just said any time that because of a conflict of interest, the Attorney General cannot carry on the case, then they may hire, but in other cases...
Well, there will be other situations, because there will be cases where even though we could, it's our own judgment that public policy, the way we understand it, dictates against our representing the judge because we think he's flat wrong. And it seems to me that we ought to be free to make that judgment. We do in other situations. We refuse to represent state agencies on occasions where we think they've just done the wrong thing. I do turn down such cases, and they're normally sustained by the Attorney General. He's an independent elected official with his own responsibilities. I think he ought to be free to make those judgments. Statute contemplates it, really.
Will you try to suggest?
Yes, I will.
And we'd like to have him by Wednesday.
I thought you would. Thank you.
Anyone else on this bill? Senator John Burns, what bill are you here on? No. Oh, okay. Let's turn to Senate Bill 28. Could you state your name, please, for the record?
My name is James Clark, and I am here on behalf of the Commission on Uniform State Laws and the Oregon State Bar in support of Senate Bill 28. Senate Bill 28 is a bill drafted by the National Conference of Commissioners on Uniform State Laws to supplement the existing Uniform Enforcement of Foreign Judgments Act, which is found in Chapter 24 of the Oregon Revised Statute. Chapter 24 provides for the enforcement of judgments entered by the courts of other states which are entitled to full faith and credit. The present act, number 28, is designed to supplement Chapter 24 by providing for a similar procedure in proper cases for the enforcement of the judgments entered by for money entered by the courts of other countries, which are not entitled to full faith and credit. The Uniform Act, in general, codifies the existing common law of comity, which is the basis, non-statutory basis, on which foreign judgments are now enforced without a new trial of the merits of the cases. And there are minimum standards which have to be met. We are, of course, in this area dealing with a wide range of juridical systems. The courts and the legal systems of other countries are frequently different from ours, and it is therefore necessary when you are drafting a statute for the enforcement of foreign judgments that certain minimum standards be prescribed, which will protect American citizens who may become involved in litigation in foreign countries from having a judgment enforced against them here which violates our concept of fairness or due process. The principal reason why this legislation is now considered desirable is that in most civil law countries, and that is most of the countries of the world, the enforcement of a judgment rendered in the United States against a local citizen over there requires certificates of reciprocity. By that, I mean that the court in, say, France, before it will register an American judgment against a French subject or citizen, requires that there be proof that the state that rendered the American judgment grants similar recognition to the judgment of a French court. This has raised difficulty in a number of cases because, as for example in Oregon, there is no case law, and it is therefore difficult to establish that reciprocity exists. This has not caused difficulty up to now, so far as Oregon is concerned, but with the foreign trade and commerce of the state growing as it is, it is, we think, advisable that legislation of this kind be adopted. This Uniform Act has been adopted by 10 states, including the principal commercial states of New York, Massachusetts, Illinois, California, and Michigan. It has also been adopted by Washington, so the states to the north and south of us both have it.
Is this identical form?
In the form of the Uniform Act, is my understanding, yes.
And this is that form?
This is that form. Now, I said that because of the nature of the problem, because the money judgments that are involved are sometimes rendered in countries whose courts follow quite different rules from ours, there are exceptions. The thrust of the Act is to make foreign judgments enforceable. And it provides that a final money judgment rendered by a foreign court will be conclusive and will be entitled to registration like the judgment of a sister state, except in certain defined cases. And these are if the system under which it was rendered is one which does not provide an impartial tribunal, if the procedures of the foreign court violate our concepts of due process, if there's a lack of personal jurisdiction, or a lack of jurisdiction over the subject matter. In those cases, the defendant can defend, and if he can show this, the judgment will not be entitled to enforcement. In addition, the state court would have discretion to reject the foreign judgment in another group of situations which were deemed necessary to provide standards compatible with our own. If there was insufficient notice to defend, if there's a proof of fraud, if the cause of action that resulted in the judgment is one which is contrary to our public policy, if there's a conflict with another judgment, if the judgment violates a contract for the submission of the dispute, commercial contracts will frequently prescribe a forum, or if the case is one in which the forum in which the judgment was entered was manifestly inconvenient for the parties, unsuitable, in those cases, our court would have jurisdiction to refuse to certify the judgment. Now, the manner of enforcement of a foreign judgment under this Act would be the same as the manner of the enforcement of a judgment of a sister state. The statute also would provide for a stay pending an appeal of the foreign judgment, so that if you are a state, let's say it's a British judgment, and you're on appeal to the Court of Appeals in London, you would be able to get a stay in this state until that appeal had been decided. It provides minimum standards. It is not exhaustive. It also provides that judgments can be recognized under principles of comity, which may go farther in different situations. We feel that in the interest of the commercial life of the state, and as a proper and well-drafted supplement to the existing statute, Chapter 24, that this bill is desirable and should be passed.
Question for Mr. Clark.
Is this the Uniform Act, or is this an amendment to the
This is the Uniform Act.
Right.
We now have the Uniform Enforcement of Foreign Judgments Act, which applies to the judgments of sister states. This is a second Uniform Act, which applies to judgments which are not entitled to full faith and credit.
And its proper title is?
The Uniform Foreign Money Judgment Recognition Act.
Further questions? Thank you very much, Mr. Clark.
Thank you.
I'm sorry, I can't read the name. Richard?
Richard Lansfield. I'm here with Mr. Clark. I don't have anything that I can add to improve on Mr. Clark's presentation.
Okay. Diana? Is this bill in good order?
I think the bill is good.
You don't see any problems with it?
I don't see any problems with it.
Is there a motion on the bill? Senator Brown moves Senate Bill 28 out with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Clerk, call and roll. Then let's turn to Senate Bill 139. Glenn Nixmacher.
Assistant Administrator with the Children's Services Division, and I'm here today to give some background on Senate Bill 139, and I think there's a very brief handout that you've already received. Senate Bill 139 and two or three other bills which were introduced at the request of the Children's Services Division do have cross-reference or interest, and in some cases even conflict with the Senate Bill 2 that is being considered by this committee. This matter relates to the issue of detention and the types of children that can be detained and limitations and lengths of time that these children can be detained. As many of you are aware, there's been a great deal of reaction to the impact of Senate Bill 703 that was passed by the last session. And we certainly are requesting that the Judiciary Committee, as well as the legislature as a whole, rethink that policy statement that was adopted by Senate Bill 703. As I indicated, this Senate Bill 139 was proposed by our agency prior to the time that the Interim Committee had fully completed their activities. I would request that the Judiciary Committee consider our input as it relates to that document at the time that you're considering it, after you've received the full fiscal impact statement from the Law Enforcement Council, and we would be prepared to return and add further input in specific areas of interest or concern.
Okay. Questions for Mr. Dick Barker? Thank you very much. Pauline Nance.
Thank you. I'm Pauline Anderson. I represent the American Civil Liberties Union of Oregon. The ACLU of Oregon believes that Senate Bill 139, which would remove the restrictive provisions of current statute regarding detention of juveniles taking them through temporary custody, is bad. It would make overbroad the criteria for placing a child in detention or lockup rather than in shelter care. The quote, except where inconsistent with the safety and welfare of the child or of others, end quote, on page 2, line 8, is very broad as opposed to current law. The current law is on page 2, line 10 to 13, which does restrict placement in detention to a child likely to be under the jurisdiction of the court by reason of delinquency or whose behavior immediately endangers the physical welfare of the child or another. The judge, including the non-lawyer judge, has, practically speaking, unbridled discretion in placing the child in detention rather than in shelter care. This bill gives carte blanche to the person responsible for that placement. Senate Bill 139 would also remove the 72-hour restriction on the court-ordered detention of such a child, making it possible to keep him or her locked up until a hearing on the matter of detention is held. ACLU would submit that, imperfect as current statute is regarding status offenses, it still provides some defendable restrictions on the detention of juveniles who have not been charged with any crime. We do have a horror story of a girl who is on probation in Eastern Oregon, and she was allowed to go to a party, and at the time, while the party was in session, it was raided, and evidently there was pot found at the party, although the girl was not evidently using the pot. And she was put in jail because she was on probation, and she was kept there for 30 days because they didn't get around to a hearing in her case. Evidently, the court doesn't convene regularly, and she was kept in jail for want of other place of detention for 30 days. And we think this is unconscionable, and the 72-hour restriction is essential. And also, we find that the change is overbroad and would give. As I said, unbridled discretion to the person responsible for placement.
What happened is that? Thank you very much. Senate Bill 142. Glenn?
For the record, again, Glenn Knickerbocker with Children's Services Division. Senate Bill 142 is a piece of legislation that, again, was introduced at our request and basically addresses a issue which, although not an overwhelming one in terms of the numbers, is of great concern to various police officers and our Children's Services Division staff when they are faced with investigating and being able to substantiate alleged child abuse situations. At the present time, ORS 419585 prohibits the photographing and or fingerprinting of children without authorization from a juvenile court judge. I'd like to hasten to state that it is possible to gain this authorization usually upon our request, but there have been situations where, because of the timing, it was a weekend, or the judge in some of the smaller counties was unavailable, there is a delay in gaining this authorization. This piece of legislation would authorize and the discretion of the law enforcement officer or the CSD staff person to take pictures of an alleged abused child to maintain some evidence which might be admissible to reflect bruises, welts, abrasions, or lacerations where they have a tendency to disappear very quickly. As I indicated in the material I handed out, about anywhere from 50 to 60% of the children reported over the last 3 years on a suspected abuse complaint had these types of injuries as the primary identification factors. I would like to point out that this bill may, in some ways, at least, if not be in conflict, raise another policy issue with another that this committee has already taken testimony on, which is Senate Bill 3. I would request that the committee give consideration to Senate Bill 142 in a separate light, as I feel that that piece of legislation is geared towards a totally different direction than the intent of our Senate Bill 142. I'd be happy.
They're not really in conflict, though. They just amend a different part of the statute. In
the reason that I say it's in contact or in conflict, Senator, is that ours is intended to be a protection for the child. As I understand Senate Bill 3, the intention is that it can be a tool whereby children can be determined to be in the jurisdiction of the court or not in the jurisdiction of the court by their fingerprints or whatever. Now, I think that the one piece of legislation is geared towards children, conceivably. I feel our piece of legislation is geared towards the best interest of children.
Question of Mr. Knickerbocker.
Is this the bill that passed the Senate in the last session in this form and then died in the House Judiciary Committee during the close of the session?
I believe that piece of legislation, I did not review that before I came today, but if I recall right, that included not only the authorization to take pictures, but also the fingerprint. And this, our request this time is excluding fingerprinting.
How was that bill in its original format introduced last time?
I'm sorry, Senator, I can't answer that. I do not know.
As I recall, we added fingerprints to the bill, to a comparable bill at this committee level in the last session for purposes of identifying a child who was a possible homicide victim as a result of child abuse.
I wasn't present when, but I did understand that both of those elements were in that draft.
Would you object to the fingerprinting of an abused child?
I have no objection with fingerprinting or photographing as long as it's geared towards the best interest of the child as opposed to a prosecutory function. Now, I realize you may be prosecuting the parent in this regard, but I'm looking at it totally from what I perceive as the best interest of the child.
Further questions? Thank you. Oh, just a minute, please. Senator Wyatt.
Well, then, would you object to fingerprinting all children?
I can only speak to that personally. My agency is not taking a stance on that at all. Yes, I do oppose fingerprinting all children in that broad sense.
Yes.
Could you give us an example of when a situation where you would see bruises on a child and you wouldn't be able to, the getting of the permission from the judge, you wouldn't be able to get that in time.
The types of situations where that may occur are on evenings or weekends are in small rural or large geographical rural communities where the judge may be in a different location and the judge isn't due back until the following Monday. In those types of situations, it's my understanding they have had difficulty in getting this authorization.
Would there be kind of a way off between that happening and somebody being overzealous and taking photographs when the marks on the child's body weren't actually caused by child abuse before a supervisor could
I
possibly get involved in reviewing the case like that. Aren't we giving up something if we in exchange for having more speed?
The potential that you're giving up if in fact an abuse situation did occur and if in fact the determining factor was whether pictures had been taken or not, and if in fact that child were at a later date and a second incident killed, we very well might have been able to intercede in that. Now, I cannot say that there were 35 children killed in the state of Oregon last year because this legislation did not exist. I'm just here representing what some of our staff and some of the law enforcement staff have said would be a better way to deal with this issue. I think you're...
Brown.
Do you find abuse shown who have been the victims of homicide who are difficult to identify because you don't have fingerprints?
I have never had any personal experience with that. I do know of situations where a child is found, say, in an alley in a garbage can, and the identity of that child is unknown, and all that type of thing, but I don't have any specific knowledge.
What does Section 2 of Section 2 mean?
Find my copy of the bill here.
Just so they can be entered into evidence.
You're talking about subsection 1 of section 2 or subsection 2?
Subsection 2 of section 2.
I'm not an attorney, Senator, but my reading of that would be that they then become part of our official record and are covered under the normal either public records or confidentiality statutes that relate to our other records. And my understanding of this would be that these would be considered confidential matters that would not be available to the public.
Then they would not be available to a court of law prosecuting the child's parents?
If information is presented to the court and the court determines the legality or the appropriateness of admission or not admission, we always follow the direction of the court in terms of the... But if the child were our client and a parent came in to request to see those pictures, we would deny him access without permission from the court, he or she.
Oh, and did anyone else wish to testify on this? Then we'll turn to 146.
That's our bill also. You want to see. Again, Glenda Kerbacher for Children's Services Division. I'm here today to speak in support of Senate Bill 146. Senate Bill 146, again, is one of those pieces of legislation that is addressed in Senate Bill 2. I would like to point out to the committee that there was a great deal of discussion and debate during the interim as to the impact of Senate Bill 2 as it related to the court's authority to tell us what to do are in Senate Bill 146. At the time that the interim committee completed their work on this particular item, I was of the impression that I understood what it was that the intent of the committee was. I am not sure in reading it, again, I am not an attorney, but I'm not sure that that was clearly reflected in what was finally adopted in Senate Bill 2, or a segment of Senate Bill 2. Senate Bill 146 is an effort on our part to make it very clear as to the responsibilities, to clarify without any question that, in fact, Children's Services Division, on the basis of the guardianship and jurisdiction given to us by the Juvenile Department, our Juvenile Court, has unquestionable authority to determine what happens to children placed in our care and custody. This is, of course, always with the understanding that the court at any time that they want to review and or remove that authority has the full right to do that. As many of you are aware, it became an issue earlier this year when a judge in Multnomah County argued with our interpretation of the law, took us to the appeals court, and the appeals court, at least as I'm told by some attorneys I've talked to, really did not answer the total issue. They answered an element of the issue, but they didn't answer the total issue. I feel it's very important that this be clarified, and this is why we would request that Senate Bill 146 be given serious consideration either at the time that you're specifically going through that section in Senate Bill 2 or on a separate occasion.
You're trying to undo the Richardson case with this?
I'm afraid I can't answer that, Senator, because I'm not really sure that I can interpret the Richardson case any more than I can the appeals case that came out of Multnomah County.
Madam Chairman.
Senator Smith.
I notice this bill says the final authority, and I'm you preface your statement by saying that the court may at any time reverse its position with respect to the child.
As I understand it, Senator Smith, our authority to relate to a child is based upon the guardianship which is given to us by the juvenile court on the basis of certain grounds of jurisdiction. Mm-hmm. The court has that authority. They're the only person that has that authority. They have the right to extend that authority to us. They have the right to withdraw that authority from us. However, that's not a sufficient answer in that if they do withdraw that authority, they also have withdrawn whatever ability we had to provide a particular resource that a child needed. In other words, they had to provide it themselves rather than looking to Children Services Division to, in essence, cover the expense.
Well, it's, is there any appeal from the final authority? So obviously there isn't, with the exception of the court's decision to withdraw custody from you of the child again.
They can ask us to come back at any time and submit a subsequent plan or an update or a progress report. But that would be within the context of a judicial proceeding, as I understand.
Now, the need for this bill arose because there was a problem between the court determination of the type, method, extent, services to be rendered to a child and the Children's Services determination. Is that what I'm interested in saying?
The Children's Services Division's fiscal ability to respond to that. And I can give you the specific example.
What do you mean? You didn't have enough money to handle it?
Specifically, we were given an out-of-state budget allocation to purchase the specialized services for children out-of-state and told by the Ways and Means Committee to stick to that and not exceed it and certain other kinds of criteria. We advised the court that all of that money was obligated, and we were ordered by the court to place the child anyway. That was the issue that went, as I understand it.
You're talking about the Van Homer case.
Yes. Yeah. And I can't speak to the specifics of the Richardson case, all that.
What was the Richardson case?
The parents wanted to have visitation rights with the child. The Children's Services said that while the child was in within its care, they would not allow the parents to visit it. Then the statute was changed so that the court could direct Children's Services to allow visitation with the child.
Then this would negate that decision, of course, since it gives final authority. And I assume that's correct, right?
Yeah, I honestly couldn't say whether that negates
well,
it or not.
Well, I suppose that parents could petition the court.
They
can
petition the court to remove the child from Children's Services, but then you've got it on the
rundown. You've got the whole issue.
Further questions? Senator Wyatt.
If what you're saying, like in the Richardson case, is the court. The court couldn't insist that the Children's Services allow visitation if Children's Services refused without taking the child away from Children's Services Division.
That changed. The first Richardson case said that the court had no authority to allow visitation. Then the statute was changed and the second Richardson case that the court did indeed have authority.
And would this statute perhaps put it back to where the court wouldn't have
put it back where it started?
Yeah.
Unless they withdrew the child completely from Children's Services and placed the child on its own, of course.
Further questions?
Senator
Arden, thank you very much. Anyone else would testify on that bill? Senate Bill 153. Okay, boy.
Chairman Brown, members of the committee. I am J.B. Boyd, right-of-way engineer for the State Highway Division. I am accompanied today by Mr. Jack Solis, Assistant Attorney General, and Mr. Milner Mead, our appraisal supervisor. I have given each of you a copy of a memorandum that I have written. I would like to read the first and last paragraphs of this testimony and then answer any questions you might have.
You picked the seats that you needed for or against the bill.
Well, history has generally given us the responsibility of merely bringing to you the information as we see it. That may, due to changes in the laws, lobbying laws, things like that, maybe we'll have to indicate whether we're for or against this session. But normally, in the past, we have just merely brought to you our best judgment as to what was said. And that was my intention today, even though I kind of questioned the X mark. The existing situation, state and federal laws are designed to allow the acquisition of real property when needed for public projects. Items other than land or improvements, trade fixtures, which are used as an integral part in the conduct of the existing business, can be defined as real property only if they meet the historical test of attachment, use, and intent. Items used as an integral part in the conduct of an existing business, but which do not meet the historical test, must be defined as personal property, and they thus may not be acquired along with the needed real property, nor can compensation be paid for damages suffered by such items when they are used in conjunction with real property, which may be damaged by virtue of a partial taking from that real property. The conclusion, the Uniform Relocation Assistance and Real Properties Acquisitions Policy Act of 1970 clearly indicates congressional intent to compensate property owners for substantiated losses attributable to public acquisition projects. This proposed bill provides the lawful means to compensate property owners in Oregon for losses heretofore held to be non-compensable. While federal participation in such acquisitions may not be immediately available, we feel that current trends, coupled with apparent congressional intent, will ultimately result in comparable changes in federal law. We further feel that whether or not federal participation is available, the savings attributable to probable negotiated settlements in lieu of unpredictable costs in condemnation actions, together with the provision for a more equitable rule in the determination of just compensation, warrants the broadening of this law. The Highway Division of the Oregon Department of Transportation urges your favorable consideration of the proposed legislation, which is in conflict with what we put on the sheet.
Question, Mr. Boyd.
Madam Chairman. How have you been handling this in the past? I assume that you've taken a look at property and your appraisers have made accommodation for some of the destruction that's caused the fixtures, etc. in the past.
We have tried to the extent that we've been legally able to. We are, of course, subject to the determination of the court. But we have recognized.
Well, I mean, you don't go to court on every one, you negotiate.
We have tried to use our best judgment, but the Federal Highway Administration has refused to participate in our judgment in some cases. And this will help us fight that battle, is what we're really saying here. We have, when dealing with a property owner, and we see that the items are actually personal property, we have had to make negotiated settlements with them. But then that causes us a problem in that the federal government says no, and we have to accept that. The cost.
How much more money is this bill going to cost the Highway Commission?
We believe that it will cost, in the net result of being able to negotiate with people and being able to make these settlements based on these principles, We believe it will save considerable money. The estimate of what this is, I would say in the case of, in some instances, we can save, well, to give you an instance, our condemnation actions probably are costing in excess of 100% more than what we believe our just compensation in the cases of settlements that we can make with the property owner peacefully. To state that in figures, it's a little difficult because each is so different. We have several bad cases. Pardon me, I didn't mean to interrupt. Empire Building Block case where it went to court, maybe you're familiar with it, was a determination. This court made certain judgments as to which was fixtures and which were not. And we believe that we could have settled this if we could have defined these in a better fashion than we did. And in a hospital, very difficult to determine whether these are trade fixtures or not. When separated from the real estate, they lose their value completely.
Always when you start talking about fixtures, it always reminds me of Jack Solis, who's my law professor in contracts, who said he figured out what was a fixture by the doctrine of unscrewability.
Doesn't sound very political.
But what kinds of cases are involved? What are we talking about?
We're talking about the little mother and mom and papa store, where they have in their possession. I have one particular that I'm negotiating with right at the present time. That a lot of the value, these are two elderly ladies, there's a lot of the value in the complete package in refrigerators, in meat slicers, things like that, which when we look at them, they're personal property. But when that person removes them from that real estate and tries to sell them, they get a tremendous loss in the value of those fixtures. They are necessary for that business to exist. But for that person to dispose of them separated from the real estate, historically it shows a great loss in value.
Right now, what is it you, I would think under those circumstances, it should be easy to negotiate.
But with. Not to get federal participation.
So, yeah.
Vern, can I help on the answer to that? Yes, Jack Solis, Assistant Attorney General, assigned to the Highway Division. Take an example of a grocery store. The produce coolers, the beverage coolers, the ice cream cooler, all of the compressors that operate that and everything else are not considered fixtures under the strict interpretation of Oregon law, taking into account whether it's affixed to the realty, how it's affixed, whether you can remove it without damage to the particular realty, and what the intent of the owner is. His intention, of course, is to leave it there as long as he runs the business. But the test that they have given on the method of whether it's fastened down or not, a beverage cooler just sits on the floor and it may be worth $5,000. And its only method of attachment is by a cable that plugs it into the electrical system and another pipe that runs down to the compressor that sends the gases to it to keep it cold. And therefore, that is not considered a fixture because it isn't fastened down. Technically, I think under the Oregon law, if the owner had gone along and fastened it down with a bracket to the floor, it probably would have been considered a fixture. And this is the thing that we feel is artificial in making a determination as to fixtures, because many times the judges, and they rule, each judge has his own rule of thumb that he uses on fixtures. One judge says, well, if it's fastened down by a screw, it's enough. Others say it has to be bolted substantially. And we don't know in advance how a judge is going to rule on a particular case. We had one case in which a judge ruled that a desk out in the shop part of the building was a fixture because it was used by the foreman. The other one used by a secretary in the office was not, yet they are identical. And the fact that there is so much disagreement as to what the real test for fixtures is under the Oregon case law, we feel it would be much more beneficial to know exactly what the fixtures are. So when we're negotiating with the people, they know what the fixtures are, we know what they are. If they want to retain them and use them in another business, they can, and they can get relocation.
But if we know where our common ground is, a lot of these cases would be settled short of condemnation. When we go into condemnation, many times the big issue is fixtures. If the judge rules that all of the items that the defendant has claimed are fixtures, it adds maybe $50,000 to the verdict, for which we pay about a third or more as attorney's fees, another $15,000 or $20,000 in court costs. Those costs add up substantially, plus our own costs for prosecuting the case. And a lot of these cases we could settle with the landowner if we had a definitive definition of fixtures.
Now, this doesn't give you a definitive definition, doesn't it? It just allows you to condemn it.
No, this, I think, will give you a pretty definitive definition of what a fixture is.
Is this going to be all-inclusive or just when it comes to acquisition for public purposes? In other words, are we changing the whole law on fixtures, or are we changing it only as to a condemnation?
Well, this is the acquisition of fixtures for public purposes by a state agency for public purposes.
Now, we're not changing the entire law of...
We're not delving into the private sector as what's between fixtures between a landlord and a tenant in a private transaction.
No, we're not. What's inventory and what's fixtures?
Right.
We're not changing for tax purposes,
for
example.
No.
And you're sure of that?
Right. We have one particular case, for instance, a Supreme Court case that says a gas pump is personal property. And yet, if there's anything that was ever bolted down or affixed to the realty, and especially set up on an island, as a fixture, it's a gas pump, but the Supreme Court said it's personal property. We're talking about solely for the purposes of determining what is real property when it's acquired for public purposes.
Madam Chairman, I think Jack is probably right, but I think we better be very sure that we maybe even put an express disclaimer in here that this only relates to this act, because it could have rather substantial tax consequences.
But this is the only place that it's intended to cover is when property is being acquired for public purposes.
Let's take the beverage cooler situation. It's disattached by the electric cord. Classically, it's not a fixture.
That's right.
Are you defining it as a fixture here?
Yes.
So you're going to be defining things as fixtures, which are really not fixtures.
Well,
the common law.
No, let's look at this
compensation.
The case law in Oregon, under the strict test, it would not be a fixture. Most of the circuit court judges will rule it as is. And we've taken a couple of cases up on appeal to try to get it defined. Try as we can, we have not been able to get a definitive definition in so many words as exactly what a fixture is. And we have been ruled against so many times in circuit court on the determination of what fixtures is, and it costs us so much money in the increased verdicts that we would like to have a definitive definition.
How is this meat slicer defined? It's going to be a fixture.
You're talking about an economic unit. In other words, what items of equipment are necessary for the operation of a business? I'll take a grocery store as an example, because I worked my way through law school with Vern working in a grocery store, and I know him forwards and backwards. In a grocery store, you've got cash registers, check stands, shelving, coolers, compressors, and other items like that. Without any of those, the grocery store would not be able to operate as a business. And when those items are severed, or where they're taken out, we buy the grocery store. We say, all right, all this is personal property, we're not going to pay for it. What they sell it for is virtually junk, because the used market for cash registers, check stands, shelving, and other equipment used in a grocery store and many other businesses is minimal value. Yet the landowner is forced to accept that ruling, if the circuit judge so rules, and take it out and sell it for salvage. If another circuit judge feels different, he may get paid for the whole thing. And this is an inequity that we are trying to cure, so that there's a uniform definition. If it's equipment that is installed and being operated on the premises, and it is necessary for the operation of the business, then it's a fixture. And I think this gives you a far clearer line of delineation as to what is and isn't a fixture for the courts to rule on than the hodgepodge of Oregon cases they have now, because they can go either way. The Superbill case has some very good language in it, but many judges say that it's dicta and will not use it. Other judges say it's the law.
May I add one
one thing is, as far as explanation goes. I think a specific example that possibly this legislation was begun from was a nursing home which we acquired in Portland, and which we were able to settle based on buying the personal property. We had to do it. The people were in rather bad shape and needed to be relocated. We couldn't wait for a prolonged court case. We couldn't wait for a prolonged determination by the federal government. And I acquired $45,000 of depreciated value. This was the value of the personal property as we obtained it. And I worked very diligently through all state agencies, wherever I could find to get the material to where it could be used. And I got $5,000 for it. Now, that doesn't include the cost of selling. So that's what that operator would have lost by severing that material from the real estate which he owned. And that is a hard case that I took care of.
Could we clean them? Would it, what would it do bad to this, to use some other word than fixture? Is the case law so tied up with the word fixture that you couldn't? Because the way you're using the word fixture here is an awful long ways from Senator Cook's law school definition or really any other I've ever heard. It seems to me you've got it all tied to the financial effect on it, on the relocation or the condemnation, rather than you've gotten completely away for reasons that are good from what you're saying. You've gotten completely away from the idea of whether it's attached or how it's attached. I think if we limit the act to property acquired for public purposes, and the definition of fixtures includes any machinery or equipment located or installed and used in the business, operated on real property, taken in by eminent domain, fixtures is a word of art that I think we have to maintain as long as we limit it to this particular area of the law. I don't think there's any real problem.
If you just described it
and
said that,
if we describe it as personal property, to be frank with you, it'd kill us in trying to get any participation from the federal government.
They have a rule that they don't pay.
Well,
for personal property.
That's right. They will not participate in personal property, and they have interpreted our law, and they say our interpretation of your law is that there are very few items in a grocery store, for instance, that would be considered fixtures. As I recall, in a grocery store that we reviewed with them, there were only four items in the whole store that they considered a fixture.
In other words, they won't pay for a beverage chest.
Right.
Which is personal property under our law.
Right.
But if we call it, if we define it as a fixture under our law, then
right,
they will pay.
Yes.
So we're really...
At least they've told us they would pay. Now they're starting to waver back and forth. But I think we can fight that that case with them and eventually win it. What we're talking about here is trying to get all of the people that we deal with treated equitably. And by the way the fixture definition is now in Oregon case law, especially under the Empire Block case, which says now that the judge may rule as a matter of law what is and isn't a fixture. It depends on each judge how he interprets the law. And you can get 24 different decisions in the same year on what is and isn't a fixture.
Doesn't this ever apply to private parties?
The condemnation law?
Yeah.
No.
The problem.
The fixtures...
Between parties are usually pretty well spelled out in their contract if somebody is, for instance, leasing a building that has a grocery store. What is a part of the building and what isn't is pretty well cleared out. The electrical panels, heating units that are installed and things like that will be, even if the lessor installs them, will stay with the building when he leaves. The beverage coolers and other equipment like that he can unbolt and take out without affecting the building, those are personal property, they go.
No, the fixture is the one that's attached.
Right.
And the others are something other than fixtures.
Right. But Vern, when you get to the attachment, it gets to be sort of funny in that
a machine, you may have an assembly line of machines, of which you have 12. Six may be attached to the floor. The other six, maybe because of their nature and their heaviness, are not attached to the floor, but they're all part of the production line. So you walk into the guy and say, okay, these six you got bolted down, we'll buy. The six you don't have bolted down, we won't. And the guy looks at you like you're nuts. He says, look, they're all great machines and they're part of my business. And that's why we feel that the test for fixtures is getting a little outdated.
Can't you send somebody in the day before with a handful of bolts?
That happened
that
in one
happened.
Case. They went in
happen.
With brackets and bolted every piece of machinery down with a little 90-degree bracket and a bolt.
Piece of tin.
And your wires.
When I first read this, I didn't understand at all what you're getting at, but then the thing that started worrying me was when you're talking about hospital beds and things like that in here, which, is there any danger that when you're not dealing with a common law grocery store, but you're dealing with, say, a nursing home chain that has a lot of high-powered consultants and so forth, that they will try and sell to the state a bunch of equipment that has depreciated, and they've gotten all the tax write-offs and so on? Or what you're saying is you're only going to use this as a negotiating tool? So if it was a bunch of junk and you didn't think it was worth offering very much, you still wouldn't.
We believe
still be completely protected in that area.
Senator, we believe through our appraisal process that we have given the true value to those trade fixtures as they rest in place and are being used in that property. They're depreciated, their value is set. Our thought is, of course, and what we find is true, is when that's their value right there. They're being used there. That is their true value. But you pick them up and sever them from that, why he is going to suffer an economic loss, which I don't think it would differ between the ma and pa grocery store or a service station or a business of some type, such as Empire Block.
But this doesn't in any way tie your hands from negotiating with them the lowest settlement you can get.
Depreciated value in place is the value that we place on the fixture.
We arrive at what we believe is just compensation, and that is where we start to negotiate in all public acquisitions.
Did I understand you say that there will be no fiscal impact to the state?
It's our belief that we will have a larger method of getting public federal participation in what we have actually accomplished in the past by virtue of this law. We can't guarantee it, and we believe firmly that by being able to negotiate properly with people, we will not have to go to condemnation, which our record is well known probably to the chairman and various other people. The total cost to the state, I believe, and I'm sure it's less.
I think Senator Wyers had a point there, and I was wondering what effect is given to Section 2, I was just reading that now on line 12, in determining whether a particular fixture can be removed without a substantial economic loss. Within the meaning of this section, the value of the fixture is considered as a part of the realty. It should be compared with its value if it were removed and sold. And using his example of a, let's say, a hospital or a nursing home, and all of those hospital beds, for example, and I suppose there's other equipment that might be in that kind of a facility, would you, with the passage of this law, be required, if you were to take the nursing home itself or hospital, would you be required to pay the owner for the reduction in value or alleged reduction in value of the personal property that might meet the definition in Section 2? Or is it optional, or are you stuck with it?
Yeah, I think that my appraisal supervisor behind me, Mr. Mead, would agree with me that the true test of any value is actually what the market gives to you or to anyone else. And if we were in error here, we could sell that item on the open market as we do under bid for the value that we set on it. So either way, it appears that that would be the test. What was the value of that particular item? Did it lose its value when it left the real estate? Wouldn't you say, Jack? That is an actual fact. If he owns it or we own it, it should have a certain value.
And so what you're saying is that if there's only so much demand for hospital beds, you take this hospital and there's no market, they were worth X number of dollars in place. Now, without a place to go, they're worth less, and therefore he or she or it should be compensated.
Right. These particular hospital beds, I tried through every possible avenue to sell them, state agencies, prisons, wherever, that I thought they could have a valuable place in the scheme of things, and I found that this was my loss that I incurred, was that figure from $45,000 to $5,000.
Good question. Diana?
Did you understand correctly in Section 2 that this only applies, this law would only apply to fixtures on business property, and it would not apply to fixtures on private property?
Well,
residential.
Well, of course, the relocation law that was passed and which we referred to in our testimony gives to the property owner the right to move. We pay for the moving of his personal property to another location. A Davenport or a refrigerator isn't the same between to the businessman as to the homeowner. We pick up the refrigerator and actually carry it to its new location, put it back where it was. We pay for that.
I guess my question was something that perhaps a trade fixture owned by a person, by the residential property owner, which is not being used actually in a business, something like an irrigation pump or a private garden. Could that be covered under that?
Well, we would hire, we would buy an irrigation pump in place. It's a part of the real property.
Okay. All right.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Well, we also had a question on Section 3, Subsection 2. Does that mean that an owner can be paid for fixtures which in fact belong to and are in fact removed by a tenant?
No. What the old law on fixtures is that if you're selling property and if you're buying property and which there's a tenant, he has the obligation to remove the fixtures. And the courts have distinguished in condemnation cases between whether the owner of the building also owned the fixtures as to the intent that they remain there permanently, as against the tenant on whether he intended to remain there permanently.
So that your bill would not create a situation where an owner is paid for a fixture which belongs in fact.
No.
Does this give you the discretion to buy the hospital bed, or do you have to buy the hospital bed?
It gives us the discretion. In other words, if we can't agree on a price, sale.
If they sever it, though, wouldn't there be, if they couldn't pay, assert the claim that the hospital bed is removed, that was really well, that the hospital bed is removed, the value is then reduced.
If they remove it themselves, then they don't get paid for it.
And if they leave it there, though, they could force you to buy the bed.
Yeah,
they could force us to buy the bed, and if we didn't agree on the price, we'd go to court and fight it out.
We
so
believe
there isn't
that
really any discretion.
And we believe our appraisal process.
At all.
Yeah. We believe our appraisal process defines the value of that particular item in place as it's being used. We're confident of that.
So their discretion is to take it off or leave it there, but if they leave it there, they can, and you condemn the realty, they can force you to buy the fixture as it's defined here.
Well, I didn't understand that. I thought it was discretionary with you as to whether you buy it or
not. No. It's discretionary of the owner whether he leaves them there or not. It's discretionary whether we settle the case at their figure or ours, or whether we go to condemnation. We feel that in most of the cases where we've gone to condemnation on fixture, there has not been a very big difference in opinion as to the value of the fixture. The difference of opinion is rested between what items are fixtures and what items aren't. And that's where the increases have come. In the determining the valuation of fixtures, there are businesses in Oregon that's all they do is appraise fixtures. And you can find experts that will not vary very much in determining the value of those pieces of equipment. And that has not been where the argument has been. The argument has always been what items should be included and paid for as fixtures and what items shouldn't be. And
this, this is going to have you paying for every fixture they don't want to haul away. And every
the judges in most of the cases have ruled that way.
And every piece of personal property they don't want to haul away.
No, not personal property.
It has to be something that they're using in the business and is necessary for the operation of the business.
What was the old term, lock, stock, and barrel? You're going to have to buy all the barrels they don't haul away.
No, this doesn't include their inventory. It doesn't include machinery they may have around that is no longer useful or no longer has any value or is not being used in the business.
The barrels, I would assume, were being used.
You sell them for antiques.
No, how would the barrels be used?
You have pickles.
But we say that barrel is not going to lose value by virtue of being severed from the real estate. That's a part of our appraisal process.
He's saying if he has to buy it, he can sell it for just as much and maybe make a profit. And that's basically what you're saying.
Exactly what we're saying. That the test is whether when that's severed from the real estate, it shall suffer an economic loss. Most of the things that we've talked about do suffer an economic loss.
But you're required then to buy these items of personal property, not previously the property defined as fixtures, which are going to suffer an economic loss, and hence the state is going to suffer the economic loss rather than the former property owner.
Right. So we're going to suffer the economic loss as we believe federal law says we should.
But
we believe that
they made up then, Walter, by the fact that they don't have to go to court because they'd be able to negotiate in the first place.
Right.
There's enough money on
the
court.
So people won't fight them in court to avoid. They want to get paid something for that barrel.
$5,000 to $5,000 is a lot of barrels between those two figures.
But we would have paid it anyway. We would have had to pay that if we'd had to go to court, and then there would have been a lot of people suffer on top of just the money that was spent.
Just to add one comment, I think the thing you have to analyze is in a condemnation case involving business property, what economic loss do you want to inflict on the landowner in addition to versus the state? In other words, if the state is the one that requires the property for the use of the public, how much of an economic loss do you want to place on the landowner? And in the area of fixtures, many times the you get hit with a fairly substantial loss.
Further questions? Diane, I have one more on Section 6. As I understand it, the owner of property may, upon written notice, 60 days, remove the fixture.
Right.
And then if the, in your case, say the highway division fails within 30 days to serve written notice of refusal, then you can go ahead and remove the fixture. Are there any standards, I don't see any in the fall. Are there any standards in the rest of Chapter 35 for refusal of permission to move the fixture? Or is it that the discretion of the highway division?
This would be the discretion.
After discretion.
Good question. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Mee?
I was here more just to observe.
All right. Mr. Glasser?
Mm-hmm. name is Larry Glasick. I am the real estate supervisor for the city of Salem. As I indicated on the form, I am neither for or against this particular bill. I agree wholeheartedly with Mr. Solis's and Mr. Boyd's position that something must be done to determine what a real estate fixture is more exactly. I did not obtain a copy of this proposed bill until later on this morning, and just received a copy at this hearing of the Highway Division's position. Consequently, I am, first of all, very concerned about any court case or any proposed legislation involving fixtures. I am not an attorney. I am a practitioner in the acquisition of real estate for a public body. And I am concerned about any legislation or any court cases which not only would affect us in the condemnation trial room, but also during our course of negotiations with property owners. I would like to ask if this bill, or your consideration of this bill, could be tabled until I might have had a further chance to review it and come back with some testimony which may be of some benefit.
I think it's set for work session on Wednesday.
Is testimony taken at your work session?
It could be, if you can be ready by that time.
I'll sure try. Thank you.
See you on Thursday. I mean, Wednesday. Nancy Swank.
I'm Nancy Swank of the League of Oregon Cities, and I'm here to express our concern, and again for the following of gentlemen from Salem, in that we would like some additional time to review this bill, to talk with some other cities to find out what the potential financial impact may be on cities and counties also. I noted that Mr. Solis referred to the bill dealing with state agencies. It doesn't just deal with state agencies, it would affect all public bodies if we read it. And we're concerned, for one thing, we don't have the same appraisal process. Many cities don't have the same appraisal process as the state does. We're not exactly sure at this point what would happen if fixtures if the term fixtures is defined specifically within the law. What kind of effect that might have in proceedings in court cases.
Send your support.
You don't share in this federal funding thing that was the reason for bringing this up in the first place, do you?
Mm-hmm. I don't believe so.
So it might
be
good
idea. Yeah, an urban renewal program. That's one of the concerns that we may have, is that this could affect it. Part of the bill that talks about without substantial damage to the real property on which remainder if such real property is part of a larger parcel. Okay. Possible, for instance, I was talking with city attorney's office in Salem this morning, and he was fearful that perhaps case where the city was trying to acquire property on which a substation was located, that substation might have been defined under this bill, and possibly might have been defined as a fixture, and that the city would then have to, you know, pay something for that. I guess at this point I'm just asking for a little additional time. We too could be ready to come back, I think, on Wednesday and do some more research on how this would affect.
You might like to be opted out for the door and pertain merely to the Highway Division.
Yeah. For sure.
I know you're not prepared to discuss all of the merits as it relates to your clients, but as I understand their proposal, it really works. There are two sides. You know, we don't want the state to have to pay for something where the state or the city, as the case may be, is not actually taking anything away.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, it does seem fair to me, looking at it from a citizen standpoint, and I think that I would think the cities would feel the same way. If, in fact, by another illustration, might be a sewage or you'd have matching money, by the way, probably, perhaps. You come in and you take it, and you actually are reducing the value. It just seems fair that the public body should pay for that reduction in value.
Well, okay. In
other words, we're not just talking about saving money for the state agency. We're also talking about fairness to the condemnee.
I understand that. Certainly, I don't think we would want to be unfair. However, we're also concerned about where we're going to find the money if this opens up a sort of a can of worms here, you know, a carte blanche payment for fixtures. Where the money will come from.
Attorney General's opinion says that the chartered cities have the authority to adopt tax bills and pass the emergency clause, so you have no problem at all.
Well, I'll save that for another time. One other concern that I might mention that, again, might occur is that we're wondering if this would leave open the possibility that people who had basically what amounts to junk property would not come forward and say, well, this is really worth a lot. You know, if I fix this up, I could sell it for a whole bunch. You know, and possibly that the whole thing would get thrown back into the courts anyway, and arguments would start to come on the depreciation of the property and how much it really was worth, the value. Now, I'm not a lawyer, so I'm not terribly familiar with the process, but I am here today to ask that you allow us to come back to prepare additional testimony.
We'll hear you on Wednesday.
Thank you very much.
A further question? Anything else to come before the committee?
Chairman, are you going to continue the whole meeting at 1 o'clock on Friday? I'm sure no one else cares here except me, but I do have a conflict with 1 o'clock on Friday.
Yeah.
1:30 would be better?
Well, I've got a 1 o'clock hearing. Usually last for 1 to 3.
Mm. Good time to bring up all the medical bills.
Well, I'm sure you
have
worked
it out. Don't worry about it.
No one else here cares but me.
You know, Madam Chairman, I've already raised the same point, but I happen to have a schedule. I have only one 8 o'clock meeting, and that's Friday. And maybe it would be better to have an 8 o'clock meeting on some one of the other days in lieu of that. Would you object to that?
I have only one 8 o'clock free. And that's on Monday.
We have
four. I'd be glad. I got egg one. I'd be glad to skip that clinic and come here anyway.
Yeah.
Before you
get one. Like to listen to a Marty about how to fish.
The three chosen of them.
Monday?
We have a 1
that's
o'clock
on Monday. Yeah. Yeah.
Do you have a 1 o'clock Friday?
I have four at 8 o'clock.
What day are you off?
Fishing licenses. Coming licenses.
Friday
every
No, but
where are you?
Where are
you? And you're at the other one when we need you.
You're hired. Transportation. Well, 1 o'clock.
How about Thursday? Do you have a 1 o'clock Thursday? It happens that Revenue does not have a 1 o'clock on Thursday. Does everyone else have a 1 o'clock on Thursday? Does anyone else have a 1 o'clock on Thursday?
I don't know my schedule by heart yet.
Do you?
I'm a freshman.
Yeah, I think so.
Well, how about thinking of 1 o'clock on Thursday?
I don't think I have anything at 1 o'clock. That'd be a 4-hour meeting. You've got something, Bob?
No, I don't.
Well, let's look at 1 o'clock on Thursday then.
Yeah, we'll the Friday meeting.
Yeah, we'll talk about it tomorrow. But that's 4 hours.
Oh, that's fine. That was great.
4 hours.
Well, they have 1:03 on Thursday, too. We have 1:03 on Thursday. That's worth it to get off on Friday afternoon, isn't it?
When shall I check your schedule for 1 o'clock on Thursday? The meeting's adjourned.
2 hours to reduce public input.
Why fuck for him with this?